Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, a bacteria so diabolically tricky that it eluded almost every attempt to kill it. If that sounds like the trailer from a B-movie, listen to how this begins. Husband and wife scientists, Tom Patterson and Stephanie Strathdy, are in Egypt in the fall of 2015. When Tom gets seriously ill, he's diagnosed with pancreatitis, and then doctors find a cyst that is alive with a bacteria that's so crafty it can hide itself, grab genes from other bacteria to resist some of the most powerful antibiotics we have, and elude almost every determined attempt to kill it. In their new book, Stephanie and Tom ask, how could we possibly be helpless against a species of bacteria that once was so mundane and harmless? How the hell did we get here? We're going to talk about that with the author. Stephanie Strathdy is an epidemiologist at UC San Diego. Tom Patterson is a professor of psychiatry at UC San Diego. And their new book is titled The Perfect Predator, A Scientist's Race to Save Her Husband from a Deadly Superbug. Stephanie and Tom, thank you so much for doing this. It's good to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Stephanie, the capabilities of this bacteria, and it was nicknamed Arachibacter, is that right?
Arachibacter, yeah.
Okay. They're ghoulish and they're pretty fascinating. Will you describe how this bacteria behaves and how you learned what its capabilities were?
Tom was infected with a superbug, which is essentially a bacteria that's resistant to multiple antibiotics. In his case, his bacteria acquired 51 different resistance genes to antibiotics over a period of a couple of weeks. And it was actually, you know, resilient to any antibiotic that we threw at it. And it was a shock because this is a organism that I used to plate on my Petri dishes when I was an undergrad student at the University of Toronto studying microbiology, and we never considered it a threat. We wore lab coats and gloves, and that was it.
Wow. Tom, I think at one point, Stephanie notes that you, if you hadn't been so sick, you would have admired the nimbleness, just what this bacteria could do. Is that right? I mean, since you've learned about what was happening, what have you thought?
Well, actually, you're absolutely right. In my mind, it's a it's the evolution that is really interesting. It's just like my body was the a big grassy plain in Africa, and that the bacteria were the wildebeest on their great migration, and the predators, in this case, that we brought in were the phages. However, you know, when we started, the wildebeests were eating all the grass, and that grass was my body, and I wasn't doing well at all.
Tom, you just mentioned, you just used the word evolve. This, if I understand the science of this right, it isn't like this bug is taking decades or longer than that to evolve, as I think many of us who are not scientists believe. It wasn't it actually evolving even as doctors were trying to kill it? Is that how it worked?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, when I left, initially I was in Egypt and then was medevac to Germany. And when I got to Germany, there were a few antibiotics that the bacteria was still partially sensitive to. And then a week later, I was medevac back to San Diego. And by that time, all of the bacteria, or the bacteria, evolved in such a way that there was nothing that was touching it in the way of antibiotics. So in that very short period of time, the bacteria had evolved and became A superbug, a very superbug.
Stephanie, how unusual is that?
Well, unfortunately, it's becoming more and more common. Right now in the world, each year, about 1.5 million people are dying from superbug infections. In fact, we don't have very good numbers on this. In the United States, it was initially thought that maybe about 23,000 people were dying per year, but just an estimate that came out a couple of months ago took those same data and looked at them and said, no, those numbers are, it's at least 153,000. So at the edge of what is considered to be a post-antibiotic era, where a simple scrape or surgery could lead to limb amputation or even death.
Gosh, wow. And I have to say, your own experience with this as scientists, initially as Tom is getting ill, first you think, what, it's a flu, it's something else that he's picked up. You have no idea what you're really dealing with here. Describe when your first sense of that this thing is going to be much harder to kill than you thought, when you really realized that?
Well, it started out looking pretty benign. We'd had this wonderful seafood meal on this cruise ship that was docked at Luxor. We were supposed to see the Valley of the Kings in Egypt the very next day, the highlight of our trip. And Tom, in the middle of the night, started to get violently ill. He was throwing up nonstop, and I just assumed he had food poisoning. Mm. Even through the whole next day, he was sick and sick and sick, and I thought, well, you know, he's going to need some fluids, so we should probably call a doctor to the ship. But I thought, you know, he's going to get some fluids, he'll get some antibiotics, and everything's going to be fine. And it wasn't. And the doctor had thought that things were going to be fine, too. But Tom got worse and started complaining of back pain. And that's when, you know, I started to realize, wow, this doesn't sound like food poisoning. I mean, I'm an infectious disease epidemiologist, but I don't have a medical degree. Mm-hmm. So I know just enough about medicine to get me into trouble. So I was calling colleagues back home, and I was Googling the symptoms, and I realized we were in way over our heads.
You know, Tom, Stephanie's descriptions of what this bug did to your body are really, they're kind of repulsive and they're pretty graphic, but I don't think we get the full sense of what you went through without talking about it. At one point, you're throwing up black substances. You were hallucinating. And even in the hallucinations, what, you had a sense of how seriously ill you were?
Yes. Well, I spent 9 months in the hospital in total. I think it's worth saying that had there been a cure available, I certainly would have gotten out of there a lot sooner. But over the course of that time, I had 7 cases of septic shock. I was in a coma for about 3 months. And during those comas, or those periods when I was in a coma, I was hallucinating quite vividly. And one of the things that I would hope that your listeners take home from this is I could hear, even though I was in a coma having these wild hallucinations, I was hearing people talking, and I was incorporating those conversations they were having around me into my hallucinations.
Important to know, because your awareness was more present than a lot of people think, right? When someone's in a coma, you could hear them talking about your condition.
Exactly. I mean, you're not a loaf of bread when you're in a coma, is what I say. And when doctors were standing over me talking about futility, that I was dying, I immediately started hallucinating about death. And, you know, I think that if they would be a little more careful, that it would be helpful. And, you know, to spin it the other way, family and friends were by my bedside 24/7, and that really created stimulation for my brain that kept me going and gave me reason to live.
Boy, this is really important to linger on, I think, for a minute, Stephanie, because, again, you were pulling in all of the expertise and all of the emotional help that you needed in this, particularly when it was looking like there wasn't going to be found a treatment that was going to work. So now how do you hear what Tom's experience was?
Well, we were actually in a pretty fortunate position being here at UC San Diego, where we had some of the top infectious disease doctors in the world caring for him. But they looked at me finally and said, you know, we have treated him with every antibiotic under the sun, and it's resistant to every last one of them. And there's nothing left in modern medicine's arsenal to kill this bug. We're hoping for a miracle. And, you know, I was really shocked at that because I had just assumed that antibiotics were going to get us out of this problem. And I think that that's one of the reasons we wrote this book, because if I'm an infectious disease epidemiologist and I'm blindsided by this superbug and how this has become a global problem just in the last few decades, that is a bigger threat, a more immediate threat in our lifetimes than climate change, according to the world experts, then you know, most average persons wouldn't know about this. And we decided Absolutely. That we needed to spread the word.
You get a sense, I think, in the way that you've written the book, that this is kind of a deeply humbling experience for you as a scientist, as in, I know who to turn to, and we've got all these, you know, drugs that we should be able to throw at this, and how quickly you go through all the options and you're down to practically nothing.
Yeah, it was absolutely debilitating. In fact, you know, I thought it was God's cruel joke on me for a while, thinking that, you know, as an epidemiologist, you know, you think that you're able to kind of address some of these infectious disease challenges, and yet my husband was going to be dying from an organism that I used to consider wimpy.
I want to talk about phages. Tom, you mentioned this briefly a few minutes ago. So I understand the science of this. They are viruses, and you say that they're pretty misunderstood. It's one of the main, I think, the central themes of the book. Stephanie, first, how did you turn to phages, and how would they be used in a case like this?
Well, when our doctors told us that they had run out of any options to cure Tom, and it looked pretty certain that he was going to die and die soon, I was just shaken to the core. And of course, I wanted to save him, but it occurred to me that I needed to find out what Tom wanted to do. I mean, we, like any other couple, has thought about what would happen if, you know, one of us was on life support and the other was standing by and we had our, you know, directives written out. But, you know, his mind was still alive. It was his body that was, you know, decaying by the minute. So I took his hand one day, even though he was in a coma, his eyebrows were just twitching ever so slightly. And I said, honey, I know that you've been fighting really hard, and it's okay if you want to give up, but I want to grow old with you. And if you want to live, I need a sign from you so that I can like do whatever I can to try to save you. So please, if you can hear me and you want to live, could you squeeze my hand, and I will leave no stone unturned. And I waited and I waited. And about a minute later, he squeezed my hand really hard. And I was so excited. I pumped my fist into the air and I went, oh, great. And then I thought, what do I do now? You know, I'm not a medical doctor.
Tom, how aware, I mean, what kind of memory do you have of that moment and your response to it?
Well, at that very moment, I was hallucinating that I was a snake and that I was being filmed for a documentary about death. And that made sense in this situation, given that they had slithered a tube down my throat. So that's where I think I got the snake idea. And then doctors are speaking over me about futility. And so I was thinking about, I was hallucinating that I was dying. And I heard Stephanie. It isn't like a conversation that you and I are having right now, but in the distance I heard her and knew that I wanted to live. The challenge I had was I had no hands, so I had to think for a moment about how to communicate with her, and I wrapped my body around her hand and gave her a good squeeze.
Stephanie, do you ever, I'm sure you thought of this, do you ever wonder what would have happened if you hadn't gotten the kind of response that you did?
Yeah, you know, because if he hadn't have squeezed my hand, I think I would have let him go. So there's a lot of serendipity in our story. All the planets had to line up for everything to occur in the nick of time to save his life. And we're just really blessed.
So back to the phages, Stephanie. So Tom indicates to you that he wants to live, and you take that as a sign that you have to go beyond some of the expertise that you've already marshaled for this. So what do you do? How do you get to the phages part of it?
Well, when I realized that Tom did want to live, I went home and I sat on the couch like a zombie for about an hour. And I thought, well, what do you do? How do you save a man's life? And I thought of my PhD supervisor who said, you know, like, act like a scientist, look at like at this problem, like a research question. And I just decided to go, the scientist me kind of looked at this problem and I thought, well, I should research this and try to find the experts that can help me. And I went into a search engine called PubMed that was created by the National Library of Medicine. It's like Google Scholar on steroids. It allows you to punch in different keywords, and it's absolutely free. Anybody can use it. And I put words like multi-drug resistant bacteria and alternative treatments and the name of his organism, which was Acinetobacter baumannii. And I put those into the search engine. And within about an hour, I found a paper that had some obscure treatments that we hadn't thought of yet. And one of them was bacteriophage therapy.
And as I noted, phages are viruses, I think you talk about in the book, that they are not well understood by the medical community. What's misunderstood about them?
Well, phages or bacteriophages are viruses that have naturally evolved to attack bacteria. They're thought to be the oldest and most ubiquitous organism on the planet. There's 10 million trillion trillion, that's 10 to the power of 31 phages on the planet. They were discovered around 1917 by a French Canadian, and he deduced that these were viruses that can kill bacteria, and so they should be able to kill bacterial infections. And in fact, they were used for a couple of decades with quite some success. But when penicillin came on the scene around the time of World War II, the West forgot about phages because you have to match phages specifically to the kind of bacteria that they kill. And so that's a bit finicky. On the other hand, Russia took up phage therapy quite vigorously, and that contributed to a real geopolitical bias in the West that if you were into phage therapy, you were labeled a pinko commie. So that whole aspect of things really contributed to phage therapy being put on the back burner in the West, and it was really abandoned.
Would you describe what the immune system, again, noting that you're an epidemiologist and an infectious disease specialist, what does the immune system do when a phage is introduced into the body?
Well, our bodies are actually awash in phage. We talk about our microbiomes, and most people just think about the bacteria. But really, the phage are the gatekeepers. They keep the number of bacteria in check. It's thought that there's about 30 billion phages that go in and out of our body tissues every single day. But when you're using phage to actually kill a bacterial infection as a therapeutic agent, and say you inject phage into someone's body, like we ended up doing for Tom, we were concerned that the immune system would see it as an invader and would go into overdrive, and that could result in septic shock and kill him. So that was what we were worried about, but we didn't really have any recourse because Tom was fully colonized by this Arachibacter superbug, and it was going to kill him anyway. And so even though it was considered to be a Hail Mary pass in the, you know, last quarter of the game where the, you know, quarterback is blindfolded, we took the risk.
Tom, what have you learned about phages since? I know part of this is Stephanie is really now immersed in this work, and you're not an infectious diseases specialist. But what have you learned to, you know, that applies to your own case, but may apply to other people who pick up these bacteria? What do you understand about this?
Well, a couple of things. First off, I do HIV/AIDS research. And so for me, the idea of viruses, initially I thought, oh my God, you know, virus is bad. And now I recognize that not all viruses are bad. And that's a kind of a prejudice that I think society has to get through. And then I think that a lot of people have asked the question, what happens to the phage? You know, they're in your body. Now, where do they go after they've done their business? Well, phages need food, and the food is the bacteria. And once the they've done their business and eaten up all of the bacteria, your body naturally excretes them. So from my perspective, this is great. This is a whole lot better than you get from antibiotics, which are creating collateral damage because they're so broad spectrum. They're killing off a lot of things that could actually be very good for us.
What are some of the applications that you two have investigated where phages might be very valuable?
Well, as a result of Tom's case, we've treated several other people here at UC San Diego with phage therapy and used it intravenously with some success as well. We've also consulted on at least a dozen cases internationally because phage therapy is still experimental. So the FDA has to give approval on a case-by-case basis. Now they're comfortable enough with phage therapy that they are not reserving it for only people that are at death's door like Tom was. But if you have a superbug infection that is not responding to any antibiotics, you can contact us at our new center called the Center for Innovative Phage Applications and Therapeutics, or IPATH, at UCSD. So the email address is ipath@ucsd.edu, and we can help.
I'm interested in what role you think the FDA plays in this, whether because of the processes and procedures that the FDA goes through, it discourages some of the research and investigation into something like phages, or is that not really a relevant part of this?
Well, I think the FDA is often held up as a bad guy that, prevents progress and new drug discoveries and experimental treatments. But in our case, we found that the FDA were our biggest allies. Dr. Chip Schooley, the infectious disease physician who oversaw the protocol for phage therapy in Tom's case, he contacted the FDA and was expected to tell them all about what phage therapy was and why we wanted to try it. And the FDA knew all about it. Ah. And they said, you're actually missing a lab that could help you. And they put us in touch with the U.S. Navy, who was researching phage. And it turned out that they were able to create a cocktail of phages for Tom. And we had another lab at Texas A&M that had helped as well. So without the FDA's intervention, probably Tom would not be sitting here talking to us today.
So if I recall this right, you introduce some of the phages and it looks like they're going to work. And then they stop working. Stephanie, take me through that part of this.
Well, two teams found phages that matched Tom's bacterial isolate and prepared them and sent them back to us. And we injected these into his body, first into the catheters in his abdomen because that was close to the abscess. And when he survived that, we 2 days later injected a billion phages into his bloodstream. And we waited, and Tom's daughters held my hands, and we stood around the bed, and we said, what do we do now? And Dr. Schooley, who oversaw the phage therapy protocol, said, we hope and we pray that we have the most boring 24 hours you've ever wanted. And, because if he was going to experience septic shock as a result of phage therapy, he would have in that first 24 hours. So he actually woke up 3 days later, lifted his head off the pillow and kissed his daughter's hand.
Tom, what do you remember about that?
Well, it isn't like in the movies. You don't wake up and think, gosh, I'm hungry. I'm out of steak dinner. Let's have a glass of wine.
Right.
It's a little like coming out of a fog. And the best way to describe it is my memories were coming back to me as if I had little Christmas tree lights strung in my brain that were lighting up one by one with conversations I'd have with people. It was a really remarkable experience suddenly to have somebody say something as mundane as, remember when we were at the mountains at this cabin, and suddenly you remember the smell of the oak leaves rotting, and you remember the dappled light on you. All of the mundane things that you wouldn't have otherwise thought of suddenly just blinked on. So that was a very exquisite experience, and it went on over the course of about a month, and then I seemed to have regained all of my memory.
I've got the book open to one of your interludes, which is, as all of this is going on, we're getting your perspective on what this feels like. And as noted, you said it's not like in the movies, but deeper into that passage, you say, waking up was gradual. In the beginning, everything was a haze, like I was a mummy being unwrapped by an unseen hand, layer by layer. If someone was standing right in front of my peephole, they were a part of my world. If they were off stage, even a tiny bit, they didn't exist. Meaning that your perspective was still so narrow, right? That's didn't even really have peripheral vision. Go ahead, Tom. Sorry.
That's it exactly. I felt like I was looking through a cardboard tube at the world, and my memories were restricted to some very basic things. And it was this gradual regaining of memory and a widening. It was an odd experience to have this very narrow vision. I literally didn't have peripheral vision. And, initially, I had to be taught to swallow, to talk. In my writing, there was dysgraphia so that I wasn't able to write. I mean, all of the things that you would expect to be able to do took months for me to regain that. And again, had there been phages and had I been able to be cured early, I wouldn't have gone through all of this. Torture is the only way to put it.
Another couple of sentences, because this is such an evocative part of the book. A simple touch from Steph or resurfacing of a childhood memory felt like an electric shock, setting off a cascade of neurons that would light me up branch by branch and leaf by leaf. It was jarring, but I knew it meant I was alive and hopefully that I was getting better. At what point in this, as you've described this arc of the recovery, did you feel like I can recapture what it means to be me? This kind of settle back into the identity that was familiar to you.
Well, it's kind of an interesting thing. I mean, it's something that now years later I'm still trying to fathom. I'm trying to figure out exactly what happened to me in a very weird way. Who am I has become a very basic question. I mean, I woke up in the middle of the night last night thinking about that. Do I know who I am? Do I know where I've come from? What made me who I am? And where am I going? And, I think I have a clearer picture of where I'm going. I really do believe that my experiences has the opportunity has been given to me to change the world and, to spread the word about phages and hopefully save a number of lives, thousands even of lives. It's already saved a number of lives. And having that as a legacy is very special.
Stephanie, I don't want to miss the part of the book that I've shared with a number of people as I've talked about your experience, which is where you get the phages and where, if I remember this right, where you finally find the phage that is the cure for Tom. It's in a sewer system, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, because when you realize that bacteria are the food for phages, if you need to find phages, you go to where there's a lot of bacteria and sewage and barnyard waste and garbage dumps. Some of the worst places you could imagine are the best place to go phage hunting. And so it seems a little bit crazy. I mean, now I joke with Tom and I tell him that I told you so. You were always full of you know what. But we relied on two labs, Texas A&M and the Navy Medical Research Center in Frederick, Maryland. And they literally went to, water treatment sewage facilities to collect specimens to see if they could find phages that would attack Tom's bacterial isolate. And they did, which was miraculous to me. But imagine now having, a phage library or a phage bank that's like a walk-in cooler of phages that are already characterized and sequenced, and we know what receptors they bind to and all those kinds of scientific things, it will be much easier to treat people rather than having to go to the environmental sources that we relied on.
I'm interested in the details of this. So how's the bacteria actually harvested from some of these places, the garbage dumps, the water treatment systems? And then what happens to them when it's brought back into the lab to be prepared for being administered to somebody?
Well, if you can imagine, this is an experiment that high school students and college students do. They streak bacteria onto Petri dishes, which is basically like a scientist's version of Jell-O, and they incubate it so that they can see the bacterial colonies. And if you take a sample from sewage or a pond or wherever you want to see if you have phage, you can put it directly on top of the bacterial colony and incubate it for 24 to 48 hours. And if it comes back looking like Swiss cheese, where there's holes in the agar, where there used to be a bacterial colony, even though phages are 100 times smaller than bacteria, you know that there's a sign there because the phages have gobbled up that bacterial colony. So then you know that you've got a hit. And you pluck out the phage from the agar and you can add more bacterial suspension and grow it up and purify it. And then it's ready to do its work.
So when you say purify it, what are you doing to purify it? Because that's the preparation for it to be given to the patient, yes?
Absolutely. So there's a lot of debris when you're adding phage to bacteria. Basically, the bacteria are multiplying every 20 minutes and the phage are multiplying even faster than that. So there's a lot of, the debris from the dead bacteria that you've got to get rid of. And there's different ways to extract the phage and purify it that we had to call in a lab from San Diego State University to help us with this at the last minute, because we realized that because Tom was fully colonized with this superbug, that if we just sprinkled it on his skin or put it in the tubes in his abdomen, that we could be missing a hidden reservoir of bacteria that could become resistant to the phage very quickly. And so we wanted to go intravenous. And that for that, we needed to have very, very pure phage preparations.
Okay, this is really interesting. You just, though, suggested that some people could actually be treated if they didn't have the level of colonization that you've described that Tom had by sprinkling it on their skin. How?
Absolutely. In fact, in the former Soviet Union, especially in the Republic of Georgia, where there has been a phage therapy center for decades, they're the experts in applying phage. And, they've been seeing people with, say, a diabetic toe ulcer. And in that case, you don't probably even need to go intravenous. You can just put the phage preparation directly on the ulcer. And often they see within a couple of days, it's miraculously cured. So there's a lot of examples of this, but what we need now are clinical trials to move phage therapy into a space where it isn't just an individual case anymore. If we can prove that it works just as well as antibiotics, then the FDA can license it and make it available more widely. And that's our goal now.
I'm Carrie Miller. You're listening to a conversation with Stephanie Strathdy and Thomas Patterson about their book, The Perfect Predator: A Scientist's Race to Save Her Husband from a Deadly Superbug. Tom, I have to admit that when I hear Stephanie talking about, the former Soviet Union as a place, I think you both are right. It's not, we here in the West do not think there's where the kind of medical advancement is happening that we really need to investigate. And that is a cultural bias, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think that's true of a lot of, Chinese medicines and, herbal remedies that are used in tribal cultures, all sorts of things. That's where a lot of our antibiotics actually have come from, and medicines of various sorts. And this is a good example of that. Now, I think it's worth saying that in the Republic of Georgia, they don't do IV. They do nebulizers. Like if you have a lung infection, they'll spray it into your mouth, or they have a oral preparation that you swallow, or they do it topically. But they don't have the technology to clean the phages avoid this potential septic shock. So we learned from them a lot about just everyday use and dosage and things like that. But they're learning from us, and hopefully the technology that we have will also translate in that direction. I think we all need to be open to movement in both directions.
So, Tom, if you're seeing, and Stephanie, you too, if you're seeing resistance in the medical research community, where's it coming from?
Well, it's interesting because the Infectious Disease Society, has really taken its time to kind of warm up to the idea of phages because of partly this geopolitical bias about phages being taken up so vigorously in the former Soviet Union, but also because of this idea that, you know, viruses are bad and bacteria are good. And so, you know, we presented our case to the Infectious Disease Conference last October. Mm-hmm. And there was a real sea change in the audience. So it used to be that after Tom's case was widely publicized that patients and their families would contact us for help. But now it's physicians. They're gaining respect for what we've been able to accomplish, not just here in San Diego, but in other locations. Yale University has been working on this. There's in Europe, there's a number of different research teams that are working on phage. So this case has been really upheld as one that's revitalizing phage therapy and bringing back this 100-year-old forgotten cure.
While it's not really a resistance, normally when we think about treatments and in particular antibiotic development, we turn to the pharmaceutical industry. Well, the challenge for them has been, how am I going to make money from this? This is a natural product, therefore it's not something that we can patent and make real money out of. Now, Steph will tell you about the various ways that phages can be potentially monetized. So let her, if you'd like to hear about that.
Stephanie, you're saying you do want the pharmaceutical industry to be interested in this. Is that right?
Well, we definitely need phage therapy to be scaled up. So we need somebody to, you know, come to the table with resources to make that happen. And we welcome anybody that can make that possible. In the future, we are seeing now genetically modified phage products be developed, as well as synthetic phage. And that is a new horizon, because that will mean that phages that can be patented more easily.
I know that the experience, it's clear from our conversation that the experience changed you both as scientists and parents and individuals. I am interested in how it changed your marriage.
Well, I'm just so grateful that all I wanted was just even one more day with my husband to tell him how much I loved him. And I've gotten, at least now, over 3 years. We don't take each other for granted anymore. I just want to share with everybody that, sometimes ordinary people, when your back is up against the wall, can do extraordinary things. And we had a global village that came to our rescue to make this happen. So it really put the kind back in humankind. So I want to thank many people that we haven't even met who made this miracle happen.
Stephanie, I think you might be eluding my question a little bit, though, here. I hear that you got a lot of help, but I'd really like to know if you can articulate this, how you two as married people who belong to one another, how that's changed.
It is hard to articulate how this experience has changed us. I feel like my love has no bounds, and that I've appreciated the resilience in Tom, that he decided that he wanted to live because he wanted to be with me. And there's no better compliment to someone than that.
Tom?
I jokingly say that I chose wisely, and clearly she's brilliant and was able to do, the things that needed to be done to save me. But the time and love that she put in is just boundless. Our experience was parallel. Steph and mine, she saw the physical side and didn't really understand just exactly what I was going through psychologically. And I think I didn't understand just how much psychological stress it was put on my family and friends. And so, we all need to recognize when you go through something as horrendous as I did, it's not just physical, it's psychological, and that friends and family suffer, and that we all need to pay attention to that in our recovery.
Stephanie and Tom, thank you so much for spending some time with us to talk about your experience in the book and where the research goes from here. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.
This is Stephanie Strathy and Tom Patterson. Their book, together, is called The Perfect Predator, A Scientist's Race to Save Her Husband from a Deadly Superbug.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.